If every little thing that you did made a difference, would you do things a little different?
I'm Laura Flynn, and this is Making Contact.
The events in Ferguson, Eric Garner.
The Republican takeover.
The World Cup.
Ferguson and the Brown cases.
There was the whole Ebola.
Palestine versus Israel.
The African girls that were kidnapped. Student protests in Hong Kong that went on.
The Ferguson case.
The ISIS conflict. Gosh, there was a lot of stuff.
In today's news cycle, it's challenging keeping up with the latest developments around the world. In 2014, we saw pro-democracy protests spanning 75 days in Hong Kong to the Black Lives Matter movement in the US. Often, we just get the stories when they first break. Then, once the height of a conflict diminishes, or really when another issue surfaces to the top of the news cycle, that's it. After that, we don't hear much more about the issue, even though we know that the issues remain. On today's show, we're going to bring you an update on some of the stories we've covered this year. We'll go to a protest to talk to advocates calling for an end to using Native American imagery and stereotypes in sports. We'll talk to the Center for Food Safety about the political outlook for supporters of better regulations of GMOs and pesticides. And we'll get an update on U.S. immigration policy from the National Network for Immigrant and Refugee Rights. First, I'll take you to a recent protest against the name and mascot of the Washington, D.C. professional football team. The campaign to end stereotyping of Native Americans in print and media dates back to 1968. Though in recent years, the campaign has been growing. Anthony Sewell sings a fire song in a grassy open field at the Ulistic Natural Area in Santa Clara, California. It's an early November Saturday morning. About 70 people have gathered in a circle, offering prayers and songs before marching against the professional Washington, D.C. football team's name and its mascot. One protester, Andre Cramblett, holds a sign reading, "I'm not your mascot."
I'm a Creek tribal member from here in Northern California, and we're here to request that the team from Washington take down the mascot and the name of their team to honor the wishes of Native American people. I think it dehumanizes us as Native people, and it troubles me that our children are being forced to look at these racist mascots and say, that's not who I am, and have to fight that fight that we've been fighting for 20, 30 years.
Earlier this year, we delved into the issue of American Indian sports mascots. At the time, reporter Alice Olstein visited Chief Ike's Bar in Washington, D.C. to talk to some fans of the city's professional football team.
Michael Wright comes from Akron, Ohio, where, in his words, football is king. A longtime D.C. resident and fan of the Washington football team, he says he only started hearing criticism of the name this past summer, but it immediately resonated with him.
Well, it's just discriminatory, you know. There's a lot of bad names around. They don't need to be called. To the Indians, needless to say, they got wiped out. That is not a name they want to be on.
Other fans, like Jerry Neuwirth, are on the fence.
I can understand in a way how some people would find that offensive, but I haven't met anybody personally from where I'm from, for example, that's upset about the name.
While others, like 26-year-old Sadie Macarecci, are firmly opposed to changing it.
It's what I've known for my whole life.
Sadie, who grew up in D.C. and whose parents are also fans, says she thinks the conversation over the name has been blown out of proportion.
It's kind of upsetting to me because I never thought of it as anything but a team that I love, so it's kind of unfortunate. But if it's offensive to people, then, you know, let's stop talking about it and just change it.
So you wouldn't mind it?
I would mind. I mean, that's a whole wardrobe I have to change. 20 years.
In 2013, pushed by American Indian advocacy groups, several members of Congress introduced bills that would revoke the team's patent on the name, citing a 1940s-era law that bans federal protection of any trademark that, quote, disparages any persons, institutions, or beliefs, or brings them into contempt or disrepute. It's the same law on which Susan Schoen Harjo has based decades of lawsuits and campaigns. At an event on Capitol Hill in December, the Muskegee Indian activist and longtime D.C. resident explained the crux of her case.
The federal government, when it provides trademark protection, it's saying this is something that we give our imprimatur to, that we prove, that we say is good and valid, and that we say is not disparaging, does not hold up people to contempt, does not hold people in disrepute.
Even if the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office sides with Harjo sometime in the coming months, the team will still be able to keep using its current name. But the federal government would no longer be in charge of seizing counterfeit merchandise and otherwise enforcing the team's trademark, which could take a bite out of the profits of the team and its owner.
So if you take away those trademark protections, you strip away the exclusive right of making money from this, then you have taken away the incentive for the team owners to maintain the use of it.
That was back in January. 6 months later, Susan Harjo won her case, canceling the team's trademark. The U.S. Patents and Trademarks Office called the team's name disparaging to Native Americans. The team is currently trying to appeal the trademark decision. Still, team owner Daniel Snyder refuses to change the name. On ESPN in September, Snyder said the name honors the historical heritage of the team's first coach, William Dietz, whose Native American ancestry has been brought into question.
A Redskin is a football player. A Redskin is our fans. The Washington Redskin fan base represents honor, represents respect, represents pride.
We don't feel honored by, you know, red face within the stadium, by the fake, headdresses that people dress up in and the cultural appropriation that occurs, of just taking our people and our culture and our sacred regalia and, you know, dressing themselves up in it and thinking that it's there. So, yeah, that in no way shows honor to us.
That's Morningstar Ghali, co-chair of Bay Area Coalition to End Racism in Sports, back at the rally in Santa Clara, California. She prepares with other marchers to join a larger group just outside Levi's Stadium, where the Washington, D.C. team are playing the San Francisco 49ers.
My name is Jacqueline Keeler, and I am Navajo and Dakota Sioux, and I am a founder of Eradicating Offensive Native Masketry. Came here with my family, my husband and our two children from Portland, Oregon, and we really feel very strongly that the mascotting of Native people must end. No other group is mascotted the way we are.
There is an estimated 2,000 sports teams with names and mascots referencing Native Americans. The vast majority are high schools. In terms of pro sports teams, five continue to hold on to their Native American names and imagery. Keeler says they've been busy challenging these uses.
One of the ways we're doing that is by getting rid of red face in stadiums. We got the San Francisco Giants to agree to amend their dress code this summer to basically not allow culturally inappropriate clothing. And so they gave us a number to text. And so we text foul, and that person is removed from the stadium by security. And so I will be at the next Atlanta Braves game and be ready to text and send someone out.
Keeler says they're also targeting big names in the sports apparel industry.
I'm in Portland, Oregon, and the Native community there has been protesting at Nike World Headquarters, asking Nike to stop selling Chief Wahoo and other offensive apparel. And so we will also be looking to eject people from games who are wearing things that Nike sold them.
And the pressure seems to be working. Deadspin Sports Analysis found that between the 2014 and 2013 football seasons, broadcasters were actually using Washington more often to refer to the football team rather than its actual name. Advocates say it's only a matter of time, but the team name will change. Across the U.S., many voters and lawmakers this year also faced attempts to change standing GMO and pesticide policies. Back in June, Making Contact producer Andrew Stelzer went to Oregon's Rogue Valley, where he talked to voters and farmers, including Don Tipping.
The reality is there's this huge, $40 billion organic industry now, of which a smaller percentage is seed. And when people buy organic seed, they know it doesn't have GMOs in it.
The Rogue Valley is a major player in that organic seed industry. But in 2012, they realized they were under threat. The revelation first came to farmer Chris Hardy, who was about to lease property in the town of Ashland. The owner told him the neighboring lot was leased by the Swiss company Syngenta, who was growing genetically modified sugar beets.
And I was like, genetically modified sugar beets? Okay. And then I realized we had been saving seeds for a number of years on our farm up the road, probably about a quarter of a mile away. And we were saving seeds on Swiss chard. Swiss chard's the same family as the beet family. It's all Beta vulgaris.
The problem is the narrow Rogue Valley is very windy. The U.S. Department of Agriculture recommends 4 miles between farms to ensure that Beta vulgaris pollen, like chard and kale, doesn't blow into others' fields and cross-contaminate. If GMO pollen blows into your field, your next crop might very well not be GMO-free, and you can't sell it as such. This season, Hardy's growing squash, tomatoes, and peppers, but can't plant his own seeds at this site because of Syngenta's nearby fields.
About an eighth of a mile away is a Syngenta GM sugar beet plot. And then as we look off 180 degrees off to the other direction here, that's another genetically engineered sugar beet plot. So we are surrounded virtually 360 degrees by pollen. We are upwind, we are downwind, we are all over the place.
Hardy, Tipping, and other area farmers got together to create a map of where they would grow crops each year, so no one's pollen would affect the others. But Syngenta, which has more than 36 plots throughout the valley, wouldn't participate. The company also didn't respond to requests to comment for this story. But they did spend $75,000 to try and defeat the grassroots ballot initiative banning GMO crops.
That was Making Contact producer Andrew Stelzer. In May, voters in Jackson County and neighboring Josephine County did ban GMO crops. But in November, a statewide GMO labeling initiative failed by a narrow margin. More money went into trying to convince voters on both sides than any other Oregon ballot measure. Though opponents of labeling raised more than $20 million, that's about 2.5 times more than supporters of labeling.
The industry is dumping so much money into these voter initiatives, you know, both at the state level and at the county level. Nonetheless, despite the amount of money pouring into, you know, the opposition, we haven't seen sort of, you know, people halting to push for labeling and regulations of GMOs at the state and local level.
Sylvia Wu, a staff attorney at the Center for Food Safety, joined me in the studio to talk about the recent attempts to regulate GMOs and pesticides. At the Center for Food Safety, Wu works on law and policy related to genetically engineered crops, pesticides, and other food safety issues.
And so there have been some initiatives mm-hmm. that have passed, like in Humboldt County, and then in Hawaii, there have mm-hmm. been some initiatives that have passed. But like in Hawaii, for example, they are facing legal challenges. And so what does that mean for, you know, at the local level, communities that are trying to pass some sort of regulation or over, you know, more oversight?
Right. You know, and I think that the Hawaii story has been sort of, it's been a grave, you know, David, you know, versus Goliath story, especially in the past year. You see three counties or three islands in the state of Hawaii attempting to push back on the level, you know, take back some of the control of their food and their land by trying to regulate the activities of the, you know, GE industry. Out there, the numbers and the story that Hawaii has to tell is very compelling. It's where most of the genetically modified seeds grown year round there. You're absolutely right. Every single one of those ballot initiatives that turned into law have been challenged. The Center for Food Safety has sort of stepped in and, you know, offer pro bono litigation assistance in each and every one of those challenges. What does that mean going forward? You know, having been out there several times in the past year, I don't see the movement stopping. I see the people fighting back. I think that probably means in 2015, we're going to see a lot more attempts at the local level and also at the state level from both sides, you know, of this fight, trying to propose regulations and, you know, bills to maintain the control that the state has versus, you know, trying to claim that the rights that counties have to regulate GE and pesticides.
So we've also done a show recently about pesticides chloriferous, 2,4-D.
Right.
Could you talk about those pesticides or sort of the push to try to expand the use of 2,4-D or its a variety of 2,4-D?
So I think that a lot of the genetically engineered crops in their cultivation, they are sprayed heavily with what EPA has classified as restricted use pesticide. And a restricted use pesticide is so-called because without conditions on its use, you know, it would have unreasonable adverse effect on human health and environment. And, you know, one of such effect is the issue of pesticide drift, which is one of the main problems associated with 2,4-D, in addition to its human health effect and so on. But in terms of agricultural impact, it's prone to drift, and in doing so, contaminate the environment and also harm other crops. The industry nonetheless have engineered this new 2,4-D resistant crop that, you know, they're claiming it's necessary. And the reason why they're claiming this is necessary is because the older generation or the existing generation of genetically engineered crop, the Roundup Ready generation, have bred such, you know, spread such, you know, weeds resistant to Roundup that they're claiming another pesticide is necessary. In doing so, they're really just perpetuating what we call the pesticide treadmill. It's just trading in one pesticide after another, more toxic pesticides. And it's not really the paradigm that, you know, I want to see. It's not really the paradigm that I want the future generations to grow up in. Yeah.
Back to sort of the political landscape. And again, like this, the last election, we saw, you know, initiatives across the country. You know, what's going to happen next?
I think that, you know, we're going to see, hopefully, in 2015, a lot more legislation being proposed at the state and county level. And, you know, perhaps some even at the federal level. And I'm sure we're going to see from both sides of the battle, you know, ones that are going to try to suppress local regulation and ones that are going to try to expressly state the right for localities to regulate GMOs, to demand labeling of, you know, GMOs. And I think that's why I think it's more than more important, you know, to stay involved and, you know, be part of the movement, to stay connected with, you know, your, you know, local politicians. Because I do think that 2015 is going to be, you know, a year where you're going to see multiple fights happening at the same time, both in legislators and, you know, in the courts, in the courtroom. Yeah.
We've been speaking with Sylvia Wu, staff attorney for the Center for Food Safety. Thanks again, Sylvia, for joining us.
Thank you.
We'll be right back.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. Because of generous support from listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the US, Canada, Australia, and South Africa. To find out how to donate, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact.
So we're currently walking through the desert trying to find the body of a man whose wife called him in. And it's really hot out here in the sand. I didn't think the sand was so soft. It's pretty difficult to walk through. A lot of brush around us, a lot of branches with thorns. I'm good, thank you.
If the body is found, Judge Raul Ramirez will pronounce the person dead. He's walking with a group of men. Deputy Elias Pompa, the Border Patrol Search, Trauma, and Rescue Team, and Funeral Director Alonzo Rangel, in the desert of Brooks County, Texas, a place where searches like this are all too common.
We just came across the body that they've been looking for, and it took us quite a while to get out here. It's pretty hot. I can't imagine even preparing for this and having to sit through this for days while hiding.
The body is face down in high grass beneath a group of oak trees. He's shirtless and wears modern jeans with a purple canvas belt. His tennis shoes and socks are beside him.
They're going to be taking some photos, and after that,
We're probably going to look at the clothing. Then they're going to try to get an ID. See if he's carrying an ID with him.
We know very little about him. We only know that he was with a group of 20 migrants that walked through Brooks County. He, along with his wife and another man, were separated from the group. When he died, she kept walking and was eventually detained by Border Patrol. She told them where to find his body. Rangel puts on his blue gloves and inspects the body before Ramirez pronounces him dead. The ID he was found with led us to believe he was 19, but we later found out it wasn't his. He wasn't 19, he was 20, and his name was Joel Mejia Santizo from Guatemala.
We ready, Mr. Rosa?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Joel was pronounced dead at 1:41 p.m., 2 days after his death. He is the 48th body found and picked up by Brooks County Sheriffs in 2014.
That's Making Contact producer Jasmine Lopez in the documentary Deadly Divide. And joining me now in the studio is Jasmine. So Jasmine, you just finished the documentary about a few weeks ago. A week is a long time in politics. What's happened since?
Well, President Obama took executive action on immigration, and that plan delays deportation for millions of immigrants, but it also increases border enforcement. So to find out a little bit more about the plan, I spoke with Catherine Tiktokin. She's executive director of the National Network for Immigrant and Refugee Rights. Here's our conversation.
We think maybe about 4 million undocumented immigrants will get a temporary reprieve from deportation through this executive action. And since we often fight against deportations, this is really a significant development, and we think it'll have a big impact. But we are concerned that it does leave out the majority of undocumented immigrants in this country. We're also very concerned about the intention to focus enforcement at the border. And this has been a longstanding concern of ours, and you certainly showed that in Deadly Divide, what the consequences are of the policy and the current problems of migrant deaths, as well as just the endangerment of people crossing the border. So we have a lot more to do.
So who are the people that are left out?
Well, the executive action provides administrative relief for immigrants who have lived here for more than 5 years and who have close ties with U.S. citizens, who have U.S. citizen children. And that is, a big cross-section of the undocumented population. But we have more than 11 million undocumented. I think the current estimate of those who would benefit from the administrative relief places it at about 4 million. So we're looking at maybe 7 million who will not benefit. And that, for example, includes parents of DACA recipients, the undocumented youth and students who received a temporary reprieve during the last few years. Some of their parents may not qualify for this relief. So while they may still have a renewal of DACA and have temporary residence, their parents may not. So the impact, the negative impact of those who will not qualify could really be widespread, and I think it could still intimidate a number of families from seeking, support that they're eligible for.
We heard a lot about unaccompanied youth throughout the year. How does this plan protect or not protect them?
Unfortunately, this executive action does not really help them. And this is one of the shortfalls we certainly thought with this action, that Obama could have used this as an opportunity to extend, for example, a class-wide relief for Central American refugee children to make it easier for them to obtain status. I think most experts, including the UN, agree that they are indeed refugees. They are fleeing widespread violence in three Central American countries. And for them and sometimes family members who accompanied them, they should be eligible for refugee protection. Obama could have used this opportunity to expand that protection. As it is, many of those children had undocumented parents living in this country. Those parents may or may not be qualified under this administrative relief, but it certainly did not bode well for the children. Again, it's a lost opportunity.
In Deadly Divide, we also meet Elias, who is a migrant from Honduras that is waiting to cross the border into the U.S. He contacted me last week, and he did attempt, in fact, to make the crossing. And he was caught by Border Patrol, and he was held in detention for 2 weeks, and they asked him to sign papers to be deported. And because he did not know what to do, he signed the papers and was deported back to San Pedro Sula in Honduras. And how does the new plan protect people like this? I mean, he was barred from the U.S. for 5 years, but despite the fact that he was fleeing violence and was trying to reunite with his son that lives here in the U.S.
Yeah, unfortunately for people who have tried to reenter and are detected and deported, at present there's little hope for them to benefit from this relief. There are some people who, for example, were caught and deported, say, you know, their first deportation. And there's evidence that many people signed these voluntary departure papers without really knowing what they were, or they were coerced to sign them. Mm-hmm. Many of those cases are being looked into because those people, you know, could be eligible for administrative relief. But I think this, you know, is an example of some of the shortcoming of the administrative relief in an existing law. So one task that remains is to kind of get rid of these entry and re-entry criminal convictions that are in the statutes right now. So many people who crossed the border without documents were deported. Many people have come back to take care of their families, and then they're caught and deported again. And, you know, these become felonies, and it makes them completely ineligible for any such relief and, you know, much less a legalization program, if we ever get a legalization program for undocumented. You know, this is one of these cases of really, we think, unfair and very punitive laws. Although Obama, in saying that we're deporting felons, not families, well, many of these so-called felons are family members. They are parents, they're guardians who, exactly in this case, recrossed in order to be reunited with their families. They're often the breadwinners for a family, and their families have been left destitute because of their deportation. It's not merely a question of being separated. I think we have to understand, what does that mean, separation, if you're dependent on someone for economic survival, if that parent is not there? So this goes very deep. We are going to have to continue to address that, and not just so that people might have a chance of benefiting from the administrative relief, but it's one of those basic problems of punitive immigration enforcement on the books now that really has to be changed.
We're going to have to leave it there. We've been speaking with Catherine Tuktokin, Executive Director of the National Network for Immigrant and Refugee Rights. Thanks again, Catherine, for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Back to you, Laura.
Thanks, Jasmine. And that's it for this edition of Making Contact. To find out more, visit our website at radioproject.org. That's also where you can download past shows and make a difference by supporting our work. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. The Making Contact team includes Lisa Rudman, Andrew Stelzer, George Lavender, Jasmine Lopez, Quan Booth, and Aquila Lewis. I'm Laura Flynn. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.